This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even people who don't play video games know that they involve a lot of killing. In fact, that may be all they know. From the Super Mario Brothers blithely squashing heads as they jump across the screen to the cascades of blood left in the wake of Mortal Kombat or Call of Duty, the kill-or-be-killed strategy is central to gameplay. Killscreen founder and PBS game show video host Jamin Warren takes up the question of why so much blood gets shed in gaming. And Jamin, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Interesting question to ask here. Could anybody argue that killing is not prevalent in gaming?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things to remember about any activity that you perform in video games is that at some level, it was rooted in abstraction. So a game like chess, you know, when it was developed, it rooted out of this Indian game called Chaturanga, which was a game that, you know, military generals would use to sort of simulate warfare. That had a lot of violence in abstraction. And I'm sure if you gave the creator of chess the ability to create something that was more bloody or violent, they probably would have. But we don't necessarily think of chess as a game as being particularly violent, even though that's what it's simulating. So I think one of the enduring legacies of games has a lot to do with the connection between competition, which is a very popular form of gameplay, and violence. And you see that in lots of places outside of games. Rugby, for example, is a game that young cadets would play as a way, again, military training. This idea of football in its earliest days was, you know, beloved by Teddy Roosevelt because of its martial style. So it's interesting because games operate on these two different levels, both as an abstraction, but can also have sort of like a narrative element tied to it. So.
Well, you're talking about a long history of getting people amped up, you know, to play games and competition. Any more in electronic games than in other media, for example?
That's a great question. In some ways, games are not, you know, they're a reflection of the times in which they are created. And so if you look at other, you know, if you look at other media, there's certainly, you know, a lot of violence in other places. You know, Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, for example, a lot of the gruesomeness of the Greek tragedies. Even, you know, something like Cinderella, which is coming back to theaters, you know, the original Cinderella, you know, the Grimm's fairy tales were all incredibly violent. You know, people being thrown into ovens and being cut open. And so in some ways, you know, games are just part of this longer lineage of using violence ostensibly in the service of something greater. So, and I think they're just now starting to figure out what's the responsible way to start to think about that, what's the responsible way to use that. But, you know, you can make the same argument that when Shakespeare was putting so many people to death on stage, that he was doing it to titillate and entertain.
Mm. Well, you talked to researchers who looked into the attraction of the kill or be killed nature of games. So what is going on inside of the brains of the game player when they're killing or being killed?
One of the reasons why sort of killing in games is sort of popular is, you know, it's this research that comes from Scott Rigby and Richard Ryan. It's called self-determination theory, and it's a theory that people are motivated to engage in activities in order to satisfy, you know, three basic psychological needs. And one of those needs is, you know, the feeling of confidence and power, maintaining autonomy, and feeling important to other people. And game designers often lean on that when they're trying to sort of give players something to do, because game designers, that's what they do. You have to sort of spur the player to action, either against another player or against some simulated character. And, you know, self-determination theory would sort of suggest that, that killing in games sort of meets those three criteria. Certainly you feel powerful. Certainly you are an independent person when you do that. And if you layer the right narrative elements over it, let's say you're rescuing someone, for example, it can make you feel like you're important to other people. But again, I mean, I think one of the important things to remember about violence in games is that when game designers, oftentimes when they employ it, it is an abstraction. It's something that you're sort of doing in the game, and that's why you find it in lots of non-explicit places, like Tetris, for example. You know, the sort of blocks exist or they don't exist.
Right. So give us more examples of that. I mean, the act of killing or dying in a video game can be separated from the notion of violence. So are there killing mechanisms in games that you'd consider non-violent?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, chess was the one I mentioned earlier. Certainly Super Mario Brothers, you sort of, you know, I mean, throughout its long history, you're always kind of eliminating these other characters.
Squashing their heads.
Yeah, exactly, by jumping on their heads.
But they don't look even remotely human, you know, sort of their little mushroom heads or little kind of creatures. So we're separated from this idea that we're killing another being.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really good point. You know, one of the reasons that game designers often use, like, zombies, for example, zombies or aliens or these other creatures is because it allows them to do the same thing that, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto did with Super Mario Brothers, was, you know, you can sort of kill things that aren't quite human, so it doesn't have the same kind of effect, as opposed to war games, for example, where it's sort of a requirement that you, it's kind of a requirement that, you know, you sort of have to be engaged with other people. But yeah, that's why there are these, oftentimes these stand-in sort of characters, so that you can sort of use the mechanics of competition and elimination without the sort of quote-unquote human cost attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to this idea of the narrative. It is a very sort of binary thing, right? There's life and death. There's a very simple black or white. As video games evolve, do you think those gray areas will be explored more?
Yeah, and I think that you certainly have, you know, you certainly have a lot of people who've grown up on video games that are starting to expect a lot more. You know, I don't necessarily think that the sensibilities of, you know, my sensibilities when I was a teenager were certainly as, you know, honed, or what my expectations were of media are certainly as high as they are now. So I think that is a place that games still are trying to figure out, which is, you know, violence is a part of lots of different media. I mean, you look at all the anti-heroes on television, for example, you know, shows like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones, for that matter. So there's certainly a place for violence in media. And I think what games are starting to figure out is, like, how do you structure it in a way that actually matches the narrative form? So there are ways in which, you know, some games can use violence as a way to spur the player to do something great or brave or whatever that might be. You know, a great example is, you know, Jack Bauer on the show 24. I mean, if you look at that show, he kills over 300 people over the course of, I guess, of seven, however many seasons there are, seven or eight seasons, and nobody ever thinks of Jack Bauer as being some sort of serial killer because the narrative there is so strong and captivating, so people are willing to accept that.
Right,
so,
and that's every season is supposed to be a day, so that's
exactly
a lot for a week.
He's killed a lot of people, I mean, a very short period of time. I think games are still trying to figure out how to do that. And we've, you know, the good news is that there are some good examples of, you know, I think game makers are starting to ask some bigger questions about, like, you know, if you give someone a gun, what does that ostensibly mean?
Mm-hmm.
It has to, you know, because I think players get smart and they certainly start to expect a lot more because, you know, because the bar is so much higher in things outside of games as well.
Damon, can you think of any games that don't have killing at their center that feel like really worthwhile games?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a lot of, like, tabletop games, you know, that are in the tradition of games like, you know, Ticket to Ride, for example, or Settlers of Catan. Those have, I guess, maybe some of them have more agrarian violence, I suppose, or economic violence. But, you know, another good example is a game called Journey, which came out a couple years ago, and that's a cooperative game. There's a game called Gone Home, which is excellent. It's a coming-of-age story set in the early 90s Portland. And there's a game called Kentucky Route Zero, which is like a sort of surrealist, magical adventure game that just came out last year. It kind of takes place in Kentucky, and it centers around this sort of mystical highway that may or may not exist. So,
are those board games or are those video games?
Those are digital games. Mm-hmm. So, and you, if you have like a PC or a Mac, those are all games that you, certainly with Gone Home and Kentucky Route Zero, you don't need a video game console. You can just download those online.
Damon Warren, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Of course, anytime.
Damon is founder of the video game arts and culture company Killscreen and host of the PBS Game/Show. It's really worth looking at the new game show video about this question of why killing is such a big part of video games. You can watch it at wordofmouthradio.org. After the break, we're going to speak with the director of a new documentary about the Jewish delicatessen. We'll celebrate the perfect pastrami sandwich, the fatty miracle that is schmaltz, and investigate the decline of this once American staple. That's when Word of Mouth continues.